Hello, hello. Welcome to Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree, the smoothest glass of Amarillo for your mind. I almost said the name of a different podcast there because clearly I'm not on top form today. But anyway, I'm half of your host, Nicholas Lorimer, joined as always by the other half of your hosts,
Gabriel Krauser. Bom, bom,
bom, bom. Well, we are once again going to try and keep this episode shorter than some of the last ones have been, but we have tried and failed this before, but hopefully this time we'll get it right. So please bear with us.
Third time lucky.
Yeah, third time lucky.
Also, it's like a long weekend is about to start. So we all have an incentive to take it easy and bugger off.
Oh, yeah. It's about to be Easter for all those celebrating. I hope you have a very good Easter. I'm certainly going to enjoy the long weekend.
Wrong. It's about to be Western Easter. Okay.
Yeah. No, the Orthodox Church calculates it differently.
True Easter is a long way away.
But I let's just say that there, yeah.
Orthodox. I'm teasing. I've got no opinion about when real Easter actually is.
You know, if you think that like the churches have been split for like 1,000 years, right?
Yes.
Relatively few doctrinal differences have popped up over that 1,000 years, but this is one of the most persistent ones that's become sort of entrenched, and it's very strange. Oh, yeah. You think also, that it would just be easy to work out a compromise on this one.
Can you remember how does it, like, the one group calculates it from like moon cycles and the other one
it's something like that
sun cycles?
Yeah, it's kind of weird because, you know, most
and they were Christian different calendars,
right, are based on the most Christian stuff is based on the solar calendar, right? But not Easter, because Easter is as a function of the Jewish calendar, which is a lunar calendar, because it's a certain amount of time after Passover. I can't imagine the exact rule, but it's something to do with like the first full moon after Passover or something like that.
Yeah.
Passover, because it's a lunar calendar, moves through the year, that means that Easter is always a little bit... Anyway.
I know. And for it to go on another wobbly, just to expose our epistemic humility. I remember having a quiz night once near Easter where the question was, why is Easter Sunday 3 days away from Good Friday? And I ended up reading a whole long story about how in ancient Jewish calendars, the day actually started at sunset. And so Good Friday was like, it was actually what we think of it Friday, but before sunset. So it's one day later, you know, just after sunset, and then 2 days later, just after sunset on Saturday. And then 3 days later, Sunday evening. And then it's very, look, I can't remember it properly. I didn't understand it properly at the time. Like, I drew it out and I still wasn't entirely satisfied by the version. But it's the kind of thing, I mean, part of what I find amazing about it is that it's one of those things that people sort of go through every year and don't really question or don't figure out. Yes. Like, to most people, most of the time, there's like one Easter. And there's 3 days between Friday and Sunday, and that's fine.
Yeah.
And it's always a surprise. It's like, oh no, hold on. That's anyway. We are aiming to finish recording this podcast before Easter. So
yeah, let's see if we can do that. Move on. So updates on the war or Elon Musk first?
I think let's do Elon Musk first.
Okay. So Elon has been, I'm sure many of our listeners have probably at least sort of somewhere seen some of this. Is he still the world's richest man? I know he bounced up and down a little bit in the rankings.
He's in the vicinity.
Yeah, he's like in the top three for sure. Anyway, so Elon Musk kind of started tweeting some cryptic things about Twitter, and then suddenly he announced that he had bought enough of it to get on the board to become its largest shareholder.
9.2%. Yeah.
Yeah. Then it's like not entirely clear what happened. He was going to take up his seat on the board. And then he suddenly said, oh, actually, I'm not going to. And Twitter released a thing saying, you know, we've talked with him and we all think this is for the best. And Elon didn't say specifically what had made him go off Twitter or what had made him, you know, go off being on the board. But some people were speculating in the comments in reply to him saying Elon went in there to have a frank discussion with them about free speech. And then they told him that if he's on the board, he has to speak nicely about the company. And he liked that speculation. So maybe that's what happened, at least. Maybe that's what he wants everyone to think happened. Anyway.
Well, the other speculate, I mean, the financial papers are saying if you join the board, then you can't buy up more than 14% of the company.
Right. So I don't think those are incompatible. So I think he may have wanted to go on the board, realized that he was quite distant in terms of viewpoint from a lot of the members of the board, and then decided to change his strategy. And so by not going on the board, it looks like he's making a play for the whole company. So we don't know where it is at yet, but apparently, according to some regulatory filings, he has applied to buy the whole company.
Yes. Let me read you out some of the details there. So, I mean, because this would be one of the largest purchases in the history of humankind, I think it might be the single largest purchase by an individual, but I very much stand under correction there. So, Elon Musk submitted to the board as part of the official filings. This has been released to the chairman. I'm now reading what he wrote. I invested in Twitter as I believe in its potential to be the platform for free speech around the globe, and I believe free speech is a societal imperative for a functioning democracy. However, since making my investment, I now realize the company will neither thrive nor serve the societal imperative in its current form. Twitter needs to be transformed as a private company. As a result, I'm offering to buy 100% of Twitter for $54.20 a share in cash, which is 54% more than the day he began investing in Twitter and 38% more than the day that his investment was publicly announced. My offer is my best and final offer, and if it is not accepted, I would need to reconsider my position as a shareholder. Twitter has extraordinary potential. I will unlock it, Elon Musk. So to give a sense of scale, I mean, I think that comes out at like $54 billion, something truly
healthy chunk of change.
Crazy. And the reason there's such a big difference, it's like it's 50% more than when he first bought it, but only 38% more than the day after it was announced, is because when it was announced, the share price went up by about 20%. But the point is that he's saying, he's laying down the challenge, and there's a subsequent letter which makes it more explicit, where he's saying he wants to run this sort of in the way that that Warren Buffett was thinking when he bought into the Washington Post. And Warren Buffett's purchase of shares in the Washington Post was on Katharine Graham's version, who was the publisher of the Washington Post through the Pentagon Papers and Watergate, through the heyday of American newspaper challenges to the powerful, to the corrupt, to the mendacious. The shiniest hour, I think, for American news was in that period. And part of the idea was that Buffett thought there was this social imperative to maintaining a democracy, that the kind of investment that a rich person makes when they're investing in a newspaper is partly for return on investment in financial terms. In the long run, it'll work out like that. But in the short run, that you're happy to make decisions that are going to not be as lucrative as possible, because what they're going to do is have third party effects, which are going to be so good for the country that it's going to make the country do so well that in 20 years, your asset is going to be much, much better off. And he turned out to be right. So this is the play that Elon Musk is saying. And he's saying to these guys, if you disagree, you need to tell your shareholders that they could have made 40% on their investments in a day, and that's not worth it. So you need to be explicit about the fact that you hate capitalism, something like that. You hate capitalism and you hate free speech.
Right. It's quite a gauntlet to be laid down.
but why do I think that it might not work? One person, two words, the orange firer. Right, because that's if you ask people who don't like Elon Musk, and I don't just mean personally, I mean who don't like the idea of him buying into taking over Twitter, their biggest fear is that Elon Musk will bring back Donald Trump.
Right.
And anything is justified if it's stopping Donald Trump. So
right.
Telling shareholders, no, you don't get your 40% ROI. Telling journalism students and you know Americans and people around the world, you don't get a free speech platform. You get a curated platform. That's definitely worth it if it's going to stop Donald Trump in the minds and hearts of, I would say, at least half of Americans and the vast majority of academic Americans, for example, Americans with undergraduate degrees. And I wonder if they're right. Part of me thinks that they are right.
Ah, so now here's the contentious bit. What makes you think that they're right? What is the upside, downside?
So I think here's the problem. I see two scenarios. The scenario where I think they're right is Musk takes over Twitter, brings back Donald Trump, and the social media space doesn't really change, right? So Everyone who's on Twitter stays on Twitter. Like maybe 1 million people leave Twitter and go start some niche little club. A little bit like when Donald Trump was kicked off, he started some little niche club. It went nowhere.
Yeah.
Some anti-Trump thing goes nowhere.
Yeah, he started, what's his network called? Truth. And apparently it's been sort of a total disaster from the start. It's had lots of technical problems. It has a huge waiting list. And then the waiting list doesn't seem to be moving. And just all sorts of problems there. And apparently he's really annoyed at Devin Nunes, who was the former Republican committee chairman that he put in charge of it. Apparently it doesn't seem to be taking off. And it looks like his dreams of, you know, Trump Twitter is dead on arrival, I think was probably the most likely thing to happen, because it's very hard to start a social media company, actually.
Once there are already other ones in play.
And right,
if you think about it, I mean, Trump had like 100 million followers. Even if only half his followers joined, and then they all bring on a follower who's not necessarily a Trumpian, but someone who wants to come to that network to like hate on Trump or do something else, you know, you've got 100 million people, you're off to the races, you're doing fine. But it just turns out Trump supporters, even diehard Trump supporters, hardly followed Trump to the new place. And if they did, they didn't leave Twitter because people don't go to the party in order to see the band. You know, it turns out, I mean, actually, if it's a one-off party, you set up the cool band, you set up the tentpole, people who love it will go. But Twitter's not like that. It's much more like a boarding house or like a town or a city. No one moves to a city to bump into Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
You know, she is the greatest actress in history, and I love her, and so many people love her, but no one moves to some city in the hope that they're going to bump into her. That's just not how cities work, and it's like a city. It's a huge...
Also, Twitter thrives off of the chaos and the conflict, right? Like
a city.
That I kind of don't like about it, right, is that an enormous amount of Twitter content is, at least in the political sphere of Twitter, and it's actually worth noting that Twitter has these very isolated spheres from each other. And if you only follow people, you know, who are interested in, I don't know, trains or something, right, and you're pretty strict about that, Twitter will try to suggest you people outside of that bubble. But if you really just ignore them, you can only hear about trains from your Twitter, which is both good and bad. But anyway, so on political Twitter, a big driver of content is someone with a big Twitter following on the left or right, quote tweets a lunatic on the other side, says, "Hey guys, look at what these lunatics on the other side are saying. They're evil monsters. This is why we need to stop them." And then everyone piles in and fights with each other in the comments. If you have an app like Truth, what are you going to say on it? It's just going to be screenshots from Twitter of, "Look at what the left is up to now." And then you might as well just be on Twitter.
Dude, I think Twitter is like a city in the sense that, like, once you've got enough people together, you need more people to take care of the sewerage and to help you defend yourself against the criminals and to, you know, help service you with things to distract you from the fact that you're in a city with, like, noisy neighbors. You know, very quickly, the presence of all those other people creates problems, which can only be solved by more people, which is what draws in more people, which creates more problems and more solutions. It's a wonderful thing. It's a terrible thing. Charles Dickens, et cetera, best of times, worst of times. Okay. So that's why it's very hard to displace. So in this scenario where Musk takes over and all he ends up really doing is opening up that part of the world back for Donald Trump, then I think that the political impact is that it secures the 2023 nomination for Trump. And if Trump wins the nomination for the Republican Party, America loses whoever wins the next election. Because then it's a zombie versus an orangutan.
Are you so sure about that? I mean, a lot of Republicans who, you know, are pretty keen on Trump say, "We really like him, except for the tweeting. We think that that's a bit unbecoming of a presidential candidate or a president." And so isn't he more likely to win the primary if he's not on Twitter?
Okay, you've challenged my hypothesis. Maybe. Let me give you scenario two. In scenario two case, I think that it's a great thing. This is kind of the best case scenario for me. Scenario two looks like this. Musk buys Twitter. And brings back Trump and rewrites the rules so that the algorithm does nothing.
If Musk can stop complete idiots being suggested as followers in my timeline, I'm totally on board with him.
No. I'm suggesting this. He makes the algorithm completely non-normative, right? So at the moment, as far as I can tell, the algorithm of Twitter is not as, it's a little bit like Facebook in the sense that there are judgments being made. There's like a little bit of the fingers on the scale in terms of what's gonna bring the best return to the company. And a lot of that is like, well, let's do things that are going to aggravate you more, because it turns out that humans that get really angered are going to come back more often. And the other thing is like, we're going to shadow ban or downplay things that we consider to be misinformation. You know, some things are going to get the either the outright ban or the sort of little underscore vaccine pass thing. This is not going to be like that. Musk is like, here's what we are. We're like a cell phone company. Okay. And the cell phone company has no business telling you, you know, interfering in your conversation with other people. So insofar as the algorithm's working, it's just like, number of hits, number of likes, most popular. It's just as transparent and non-normative as it could be, as amoral as it could be. And a lot of the shareholders don't want this to happen, but like the 60% of the shareholders outvote the 40% because the 60% just want that extra 40% of money. Because like, if you've got $1 million worth of Twitter shares tomorrow, you're going to have an extra $400,000, an extra 8 million, 7 million rand, whatever it is. It's hard to say no to that. But a lot of people are sitting with money that they don't really want to have because they've been bought out. And so there's a huge investment in starting a new social media company. And it's not like Trump, because it's opening seed investment is a couple of $1 billion. And that goes into making sure that all the glitches are taken care of by the smartest smarty pants in Silicon Valley. And into having not just marketing campaigns, but like the full Monty. tours of college campuses where speeches are made together with presidents of important Ivy League universities who say you must leave Twitter and join Dungus Dungus.
And it's worth thinking that that definitely could happen, because I know already some of the sort of more wokey type Twitter employees have been publicly complaining to major media outlets that they're really stressed out about the idea that Elon could buy the company and they don't want to work for him and they think he's awful. And so they would all be very keen to jump off and go and work on some new social media company that was well-funded.
And I think that would be the best case scenario. If you, and I don't mean for them to have the same kind of humiliating experience that Trump had. I mean for them to do it and for it to work. I mean for a new social media company to emerge that is, that promises the following value add. They say, we are curated. So we are going to put our fingers on the scale. We are going to make sure that disinformation about vaccines is shielded. We are going to make sure that people who use horrible swear words, people who are outright racist to black people, but not outright racist, what, you know, people are outright racist to black people are going to be banned. People are outright anti-Semitic are going to be banned. People who are outright communist are not going to be banned. You know, there is a set of values that you could call woke, that you could call various things. I don't care what you call it. There's an identifiable set of values that has more or less defined the curation of Twitter as it has been. And they reproduce that over there. And a lot of people want that, and a lot of people need that, and a lot of people go for it. Like hundreds of millions. Eventually, like in a couple of years, a billion plus people are on that platform. And then you've got Twitter, and you've got this other one.
I don't even know if a billion people are on Twitter, actually. It's one of the smaller of the social media platforms.
Right. It's one of the smaller. Okay. So whatever it is, you know, it's like almost as big as original Twitter. Dude, I'd be happy if it gets bigger than original Twitter. Because my controversial, not so controversial claim, but like I made this claim to I sent it to Philip Pettit, who is this wonderful professor at the Woodrow Wilson International School. No, it's not that anymore. At Princeton University, who wrote The Economy of Esteem, which we talk about a lot, Group Agency, which I wrote my thesis about. So I interviewed him in 2020 about the pandemic, because I thought, you know, the pandemic is bringing about this great moment for studying the economy of esteem, because some countries are trying to change people's behaviors through government force, and other governments are trying to do it just through suggestion. And that's exactly the kind of difference that the economy of esteem is all about. It's like, does just suggesting, saying this is cool and that behavior is antisocial, just saying it, just spreading that idea, does that actually change behavior? And, you know, I think South Korea, Japan, maybe it shows it does. Let's not relitigate that. The point is, we got into this conversation after the interview about the economy of esteem more broadly. And he said that he had stopped thinking about it for a time, for a number of years, because he was so depressed by what the internet had done to the economy of esteem.
Oh, glorious. Did he say what it was that broke a camel's back for him on that one?
No, I don't think there was one. The thing that broke him was that he couldn't think of a way out. Because it's like you've got two bad options. The one is to let it be free, and that doesn't work, he says, because back in the day, in the medieval period, the let it be free option was better, because the real challenge was always that one person would use force to command everyone else's attention. But that once...
very hierarchical centralized societies, or at least all of the energy in politics was trying to centralize, because society was so decentralized. It was like, you know, all the smart people said, well, look, of course the king should have more power, because otherwise the bandit lords are just going to ruin everyone's lives. And if that means that he has to tell people what they can and can't say, that's a good thing, because then we won't have so much conflict.
Dude, I mean, put it another way. Even Jesus said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. And he was saying that in the context of Roman tax collection literally being tax farming, where the idea was the consul, like some governor, says to a bunch of hooligans, you guys have to go and collect this amount of gold.
Well, and they buy a contract. They say, we're taking this much in tax. We're taking, let's say, 300 denarii in tax. You pay us 300 denarii, and then you have permission to go to this region and shake it out of the local population.
So if you can shake out 700, you can shake out 700. Don't tax too much, because then they're all going to die, and then you won't be able to come and do it again next year. That's the only incentive to not overtax the people. The tax rate is literally however much I can get out of you, and you're still around next year for me to do it again. Okay? That was, and even under that system, Jesus was like, oh, just give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Because the alternative is, you know, is anarchy. So I hear you, but I think part of his point was that just in terms of how communication worked, the problem today is different. Then it was just impossible to have what we have today, which is a whole lot of people kind of drowning out the truth. So there, the worry, you know, the way he puts it, I'm not sure if this is right, but the way he put it was, and he's written this, so I'm not quoting him extemporare, was, you know, there the worries was that one person would distort the truth by repressing all of the, repressing everyone who's actually telling the truth, and putting out one official version that's a lie. And you can see, you can imagine in medieval Europe how this works. You know, the Pope or the King or whoever, they staple to the door, to the wall. They get the town crier to say what the official version is. And if one or two other people disagree, off with their heads. But here the worry is that everyone has a microphone. Everyone has a platform. So the problem, the major problem that, that free speech laws need to deal with is not one bad actor crushing the truth. It's everyone creating a cacophony that drowns out the truth. And there, right, the free speech, let every voice speak its truth idea that worked in the 19th and 18th century, when the American founding fathers were coming up with this, when before that, classical liberals of the Enlightenment were coming up with it, that doesn't work anymore because of this technological shift. So he was like, regulation's not going to work because governments are likely to just regulate with the fingers on the scale to make things better for themselves, as clearly, you know, the Chinese are kind of the best example of that. And freedom is not going to work. So
let me give you an example of what the sort of nightmare version of the other one looks like. So the politics board, or the politically incorrect board, as it's officially called, of 4chan. What was the great discussion, the great argument that was being had on the day that that Russia invaded Ukraine? It was, guys, we need to work out whether the Jews control the Russians or the Ukrainians, so we know which side to back. Because the more Jewish side is the bad guy, obviously. So there was someone who said, Azov Battalion, that shows that the neo-Nazis are on the side of Ukraine, therefore we need to back them. And then the other side was like, no, you see, Putin is actually standing up to Jewish global tyranny and all the just like mad anti-Semitic conspiracy.
Yeah, dude. Someone said, no, Putin is a Jew. So we've
got
and Ukrainians. They said, Zelensky is a Jew.
And the esteem market, there's no barrier to entry on 4chan, right? Anyone can log in. You don't log in even. You just can post. You can post whatever you want. You can even pretend to be several different people, which is what people do all the time for fun, to cause chaos. It's like the most free that free speech can be, because you don't even have, an identity.
A stable identity.
Completely anonymous unless you don't want to be.
Yeah, you're identified as you volunteer.
Right. And in fact, people on that problem was so bad on the politics board that they actually implemented an ID system that temporarily works for each thread, because people would pretend to be a political opponent and then respond to themselves claiming that knocking down the straw man. It was anyway. So this is basically the worst case scenario of when free speech and the esteem market interact in a really twisted way to produce a discussion that is just completely beyond the pale. That's just so toxic that it's not even vaguely connected to reality.
Yeah. Accepting its connection to reality is that I think have a drink. Appiah. Call me Anthony Appiah. Cheers.
Cheers.
He makes the point, I think the most of anyone I know in the 21st century, sort of classic, really classic kind of medieval sort of Christian theological point, and a point at the heart of Buddhism and Confucianism, which is that mood management is important. You're not just a rational computing machine. Right, this idealization of Adam Smith is very good for certain purposes, but it's really bad for other purposes. Here's how things go wrong. For example, I remember Appiah telling the example that he gave back in 2009, 2010, or whatever it was in a lecture, was that in certain situations you really want to take on a quite a hard utilitarian point of view for your moral analysis, and lifeboat ethics is a kind of name for that domain. So, you know, it's the Titanic, it's sunk, you're on a lifeboat, and you know that this lifeboat can only hold 13 people. The 14th person is coming along and trying to clamber into the boat, and you just know that there's no help coming in. If this person gets into the boat, the boat's going to sink and you're all going to die. You have a moral duty to stop that person from getting on the boat. Now, you might disagree with that thought. I think it's a pretty sound thought. Appiah was not trying to sort of say one way or another. He was trying to say, if you think it's a sound idea that you should just do the terrible thing like the character does in that movie of sort of letting someone go to save someone else, letting one go to save 13, that makes sense in that particular moment. But if you always think like that, if you're always on the cusp of making some consequentialist utilitarian determination of what you should do, then you're very likely to make very bad judgments. And you can see this with people who run red traffic lights, right? They're like, nothing is wrong with running a red traffic light. If no one else is around, I'm literally harming no one. It's a victimless crime. So I don't care about the traffic light as a rule to stop and wait until it's green and then go. I consider it like a bit of information. Okay, it's red, so probably I should just slow down and check it out and see if someone's coming. But it's not a rule. And I'm going to go through it if I determine that the consequences are going to be best. And I'll admit that in Joburg, after 10 o'clock, I definitely drive like that, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's done that before.
Yeah. But if you do that all the time, the worry is that it puts your head in the wrong kind of, you're in the wrong headspace. You're in the wrong mood. And that you're much more likely to eventually cause an accident because you're being a cheeky brat, right? So I think the problem with 4chan, and I remember hearing about 4chan in the fall, November 2008 or early 2009, whatever it was, hanging out with a friend who was like, you know, working all day and then, you know, eating Adderall and snorting cocaine and whatever and smoking joints to do 8-hour binge sessions on 4chan all night when it had just started and was the sexiest thing in the world. I thought this guy's amazing. He's in this parallel universe.
Well, that's when it took off. It started in, I think, 2003, but it like started to appear in pop culture in a big way. And I think the first thing they did was actually protesting Scientology. The Church of Scientology had gotten a video of Tom Cruise that was like kind of embarrassing to them. It was supposed to be for internal consumption of the church, taken down off of like everywhere on YouTube. And random people on 4chan, this is where the whole anonymous hacker thing started.
Yes.
rally together and sort of did these half serious, half joking protests where they showed up wearing like silly masks and costumes and things outside of Church of Scientology buildings. I think like a couple thousand people showed up in various protests across the world. You know, not huge.
So I think they eventually got huge crowds. I think that was later. I think that's closer. That's Obama's second term. That's close to the election of Trump. This is Obama term. Obama's just been elected, but V for Vendetta has come out. And so the anonymous mask is around, and this is part of the thing. Okay. The point of that story is that I could see it a little bit in him. And this is what he liked about it, was that you plug into it. You plug into this esteem market where it's just outrageous, where it's all about the lols, it's all about humiliating other people. And then you unplug and you come back to reality and you can be really sweet because you've sort of vented catharsis, as Aristotle might have said. You know, you've pricked the wound and the pus has come out and your toxic emotions have been released. And so you're back to a very stable state of being. That's a nice idea. And of course, sometimes we play video games. I definitely play sport. Part of the reason that I try and play sport at least a couple of times a week, if I can, is that I do think that it's nice to release some of my manly rage on like a volleyball or a like awkwardly gangly, like I'm not very good at it, but whatever, it's like I need to sweat a bit. But the thing is about, yes, the thing about that esteem market, which is really rewarding the worst kind of behavior, is that you might get into it and for a while you get into this mood and then you unplug. Eventually you just become the guy who like cruises through, you become like a Joburg taxi driver. You're like deliberately driving up the road the wrong way through the red traffic lights, like plowing through people's gardens, destroying their dogs, killing old ladies,
care. People on 4chan are actually aware of this, and they sometimes have made memes about this very fact. One of the things that people used to do to kind of provoke outrage was pretend to be neo-Nazis, right? They'd say, Hitler did nothing wrong, the Holocaust is a lie, something like that. Like just
and totally it's catharsis. It's just an act. They just pretend.
Right, and it was just to annoy and upset people because it was kind of funny. But the problem was actual neo-Nazis looked at this and said, man, these people are our brothers. We should all go there. And so before you knew it, it was actually a community of people who weren't just trying to make people upset, but very genuinely believed this stuff and like were deep down the conspiratorial rabbit holes and were completely obsessed with, you know, the Jewish plan to take over the white race or whatever the hell they're into these days. And it's interesting to see the sort of website. It's always had like a dark, seedy underbelly, but it used to be a lot more sort of like delinquent, antisocial teenage behavior. And over the years, the site has become increasingly dominated by more. It's actually much more serious, right? More adults. People who take themselves very seriously, which is so what it never used to be.
So this is the point I was trying to build to with Appia. Appia says this all starts with children. And the easiest example is a little child with a mud cake. The amazing thing about human beings, and it's like one of the most beautiful facts to keep trying to explain, and I was recalling it because of our episode last week on the problem of childhood. Dude, one of the amazing things about childhood is that you can teach a little child how to make a mud cake, and you never have to teach it not to eat the mud cake. They know how to play. They know how to go like, ooh, that smells delicious. Ooh, hot, hot, hot. Blow their hands and put it on a little tray and cut it up with a knife and fork and feed it to the little doll, but never put it in their own mouths. Because they know, as much as they're playing, as hard as they can play act, that this is a real cake. They know that it's mud and mud is gross to eat. It takes a real grown-up mashugana to play act so hard, so often, that they end up sort of choking themselves on an actual mud cake. But the problem is that it's not just something one or two grown-ups do. It's something that every single grown-up on the planet will do if you put them in the right bit of theater sports for long enough. We are all prone to insanity. And So if there's an esteem market that's set up the wrong way, it'll bring out that worst side of us and make us get very real. Not play acting neo-Nazis, getting, you know, like proper horrible and disgusting. So is my thought that Twitter should become like that? Twitter should become the new Reddit, but just starting out with a much bigger base platform, and then the new Twitter becomes the new Twitter? No. My thought is this. I think that there is a delicate balance, which, much like the thing we were talking about last week with schools, managing just some difficult conversations with children and stuff, there's a delicate balance to be struck that you're not going to legislate very well. And the best way to get there is through a bit of competition. And I think cell phone companies are exactly the right model to think of. So like a cell phone company can be subpoenaed and can provide evidence of conversations in which terrorist plots have been conducted. Like, I do think that the law needs to step in there. And if someone on Twitter or Facebook is organizing to come and mob Nicholas's house because he is the greatest, you know, host of the Daily Friend Show, and it is liberty's shiniest torch, and the forces of South African fascism want to snuff it out.
You see, one day I hope to have that kind of relevance, but anyway.
If they're plotting that on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, Reddit, like, that should, there should be a system that raises red flags, and the government should be able to use that information to prevent the crime from taking place of burning down Nicholas's podcasting studio. That is my firm conviction. I do believe in the law. At the other end, you know, we had a podcast that was shut down. I still haven't listened to what was said, but I think nothing nefarious was said, and that's really gross. Yeah. So I think that the way to deal with it is, if there are, this is how it's worked with publishing houses. When Europe moved from a world in which the imprimatur of the Pope or the local bishopric or whatever was necessary in order to be publicly displayed as a text, that's not illegal to own or sell. When it moved from that into a space where things were fairly free, as they have been in the book world for a while, there was this in-between period of kind of publisher monopolies and retail monopolies. Things really work best when there is like two or three or four sellers that are all more or less the same. And they kind of, you know, it's like 40% market share, 30% market share, 20% market share, whatever it is. And so they all have rules to stop the worst, and they're all very tolerant. And if one of them deviates too far one way or the other way, they get punished very hard by losing market share. So they kind of keep each other in check. I think that if there were two Twitters, you know, if there's another Twitter and another Facebook, and you've got the Yandex, and the problem right now is that wherever there is competition, it's across boundaries and across language groups. So Yandex is huge. Russian, the Russian part Facebook site is still like the eighth biggest site in the world. Chinese Twitter, Facebook, you know, conversation platforms, huge.
Yeah, what's called Weibo is their version of Twitter. Weibo.
But there's no real competition there. You need in English to have Twitter and some other thing. And for most people that are plugged into one to be plugged into the other, for crossovering to be as kind of common as for me on Cell C phoning you on MTN or the other way around. So that those companies fade into the background. That's where they should be. We really shouldn't care about these companies. And I care about this story, because I think it could be a great step towards not giving a hoot about Twitter. Not because it goes away, not because Elon Musk makes it. I mean, he does have hubris. He says Twitter will be the, this is where I disagree with him. He says, I can make Twitter the platform for free speech in the world, or whatever it is. For free, I believe it's in its potential to be the platform for free speech around the globe. Nah, dude. No,
No.
That's yeah, not how it works, in my opinion.
Twitter was pretty relaxed, actually, in the beginning about some of this stuff. And then, you know, and this will happen to Musk, too, if he does actually own it. Some lunatic will tweet out, I'm going to go shoot up a school tomorrow. And then he'll go and shoot up a school. And people will say, why didn't Twitter act to take this down? Or why didn't Twitter alert the authorities? Or why didn't Twitter do X, Y, or Z? And he'll probably in the end have to at least put in some moderation. The moment you put in a little bit of moderation, it's very easy for then people to start getting in there and saying, okay, well, no, we want to allow this, not this, and this, not this. And the whole edifice kind of builds from there. I think Twitter is mainly staffed by sort of woke people whose politics I think is pretty toxic. And I think it's also staffed by a lot of people who just generally don't like the idea of free speech that much to begin with. But they originally weren't that keen on enforcing that view of the world. They were more interested in doing their jobs. And I think over time, as Twitter has built up its safety council, they have like a whole internal structure for deciding what to censor or what to take down, that kind of stuff. And they evolved into this position. They didn't just sort of arrive at it one day. They didn't say, okay, we've created Twitter and now it's time to crush the right. I think that they've sort of stepped more into that over time. And by the way, there are a lot of people on the right who would be very sad if the free speech stuff, if Twitter was less censorious of people, because there's an awful lot of people who make a lot of money by complaining that they've been censored.
Right.
No, exactly. Which is one of those funny, weird things about the internet age.
So, I mean, let me put this another way. Did the novel do best when most people were having heated discussions about which publishing house is too censorious and which one is too licentious, I beg your pardon? No, of course there are little titillating, you know, there's D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatelier's Lovers, which was, you know, too hot to handle, and then it was allowed. And I remember an ex-girlfriend reading that to me in the bath, and
that is such a Gabriel anecdote, my God.
And I thought, this book is not nearly as interesting as just like what every teenager is kind of figuring out about life at a certain late teenager stage, one hopes. I think you know it's a good book, but it's not that crazy. And Lolita got published, which is kind of germane to the conversation we were having last week. And some people were like, you shouldn't be able to allow to put this in a bookstore. So I'm not saying that there are ever going to be moments where there aren't conversations about censorship and allowance. And I think those conversations should always be alive in a way, but they should be very, very fringe. They should be making up much less of a proportion of the conversations that we have. I imagine a world in which there are two Twitters. 20 years after that, I think that the a priori inevitable forces towards becoming more and more censorial, those are connected to having a monopoly. If you've got two, there's right. also a pressure to become more licentious, because otherwise the other group is going to eat your market share of people that want more licentiousness. And as it turns out, precisely because of the network effect, this is what I'm trying to take advantage of. Precisely because of the network effect, it's always going to be difficult to get to a position where you've got a Twitter for the left and a Twitter for the right. I don't think that's ever actually going to happen, because everyone wants to fight with everyone else. So they're always going to be on both. But in the moments when a chief executive or a board makes some big decision to deviate from the norm, that's when you're going to see a shift in market share.
For example, we're going to take the president of the United States. Right.
Yes. If there had been two Twitters and someone said, we're going to take out the president of the United States, then there would have been a huge shift away, and that would have scared the board, and it would have returned to equilibrium much quicker. I think that decision would have been canceled in 24 hours, for example, which I happen to think would have been better. You know, it would have been better for him to lose with that rather than without it. as it were. Anyway, as it turns out, not what I thought at the time. The picture is really like it really is kind of my sort of belated Le Mort d'Escalier comeback to Pettit, which is that the wrong way, it just turns out you've got this choice. And I had been talking myself into the position for years and years of thinking that these guys have to be like publishing companies. They have to take much more responsibility, like editors, like newspaper editors. They really have to take much more responsibility for what they're putting out there than they do. Newspaper editors should not be getting away with any of the stuff that they're doing. But instead, I now think that the ideal would be for them to be like cell phone companies. And the contrast is this. In the case of newspaper editors, when newspapers are doing best, you are talking about the newspaper as a group. Whereas when publishing houses, cell phone companies, etc. are doing the best, you're talking about the particular conversations and the individuals having those conversations. So I never want to think of a day where there's like Twitter is like the Washington Post, like Twitter broke the story. Twitter was brave enough to do this, or Twitter was too cowardly to do that. That should never be the historical footnote to some important moment. It should always be, you know, this person said this, that person said that on Twitter, on Facebook, on MTN, on LC, on Vodafone. Who cares? Who cares who published F. Scott Fitzgerald, Great Gatsby? Who cares who published the first folio of Shakespeare? Who cares about any of that stuff? We really care about
content. I think one thing I just want to add here is I have a view that it actually, even though we talk about it, matters a huge amount. You know, one of the big things that was censored by Twitter in the lead up to the 2020 election was the story doing the rounds about Hunter Biden's laptop. Twitter said that it was a kind of unproven election meddling, Russian false information, whatever. And they blocked it from being linked to, right? The truth is, even though Twitter worked to censor it, and I think a bunch of other social media companies did as well, the story did actually, you know, kind of get out there to everyone who was listening.
No, dude, I disagree.
I didn't read about it in any way except Twitter. everyone was talking about it. That's all they were talking about. They were either talking about like how it was good that it was censored, or how it was bad that it was censored, or whatever. I really don't think that social media platforms have the power to. This is my point, is that the internet is actually already, there are no true monopolies, especially on information. There's 1,000 holes in the bucket, and everyone can get their. I see more comments online that come directly from Alex Jones, even though he's been banned off of, you know, even the App Store. And yet I still see stuff straight from his show in comment sections around the world. So I think that actually there is no such thing as a true monopoly. That doesn't mean I disagree with you, by the way. I do think two Twitters would be a very good thing. I just don't think it's that they're as important as a lot of people make them out to be.
Right. So I don't use Twitter, so I'm probably exposing a little bit of my foolishness. And thank you for checking.
I stopped using it in 2020 and only went back onto it because it was the best place to see stuff because of the war, yeah.
So I think the Hunter Biden thing sort of connects to this ancillary point I'm trying to make, which is I think there really was a huge – if you wind back, so it turns out that Hunter Biden's laptop was real and that it's got a lot of damning evidence, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, really, really embarrassing for the social media companies, for sure.
First, the newspapers. So the New York Post carried the story and the New York Times cut them. And it is a little bit like...
I think also the Wall Street Journal didn't touch it either. I may be wrong about that.
Wall Street Journal didn't touch it. New York Times said this is... actively fake news. New Yorker said it's actively fake news. The reason I'm contrasting those two is because it reminds me of the battle between the Washington Examiner and the Washington Post in the 1960s. Is a little bit like the battle between the New York Post and the New York Times in the 2020s, in the sense that the New York. This is newspaper arcana, but if you give me 5 minutes before we hop onto the war. After World War II, the Washington Examiner was an interesting newspaper. It sort of emerges into a world where some fiscal conservatives were irritated by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who became president after the Great Depression in the 1930s and promised the government would solve everyone's problems. Right. During the Great Depression, by some accounts, exacerbates the Great Depression. I'm still like Milton Friedman. I think the Federal Reserve did the worst. But FDR comes in and he says, you know, big government, big New Deal, it's going to be great. And he's so popular that it's hard to go against him. But people still do. And it seems like he might be displaced. But then World War II comes and he becomes sort of baby Jesus. You can't really criticize him out loud. And so Americans who want government to be smaller become a little bit like closeted homosexuals of Victorian England. You know, they all know each other. Most of them are fabulously stylish. They have great parties together, but in public, they would never admit to. You really would be outing someone if you said secretly you actually think FDR has taken us in the wrong direction. Yeah, you'd be pouring ash on the head in a totally unfair and unjustified way, because reasonable people, you know, some people are born fiscally conservative and others are born. I don't know. Maybe I'm taking it too far. Nicholas is laughing at me. My apologies. Here's the point. The Washington Post is competing with the Washington Examiner, where the Washington Examiner has committed itself to being a local Washington newspaper. The Washington Post is trying to compete with these newspapers that are syndicating themselves around the country, but it's really being outperformed by the Chicago Tribune and the New York Times and McClatchy sort of conglomerates that you know, buy the best journalists in the country's most famous columns and sort of pool them together in what look like local newspapers, but that are really just a sort of local face on a national background conglomerate. And there's a few others. Okay. So the Washington Examiner is really trying to be local as lacquer, and it's pretty good at it because it's in Washington, D.C., and that is the center of power. And so it's good at getting the smut. It's good at getting the most edgy cartoons. It's good at getting like mavericks that have been just too honest to really survive in politics, but that like had a good, you know, spent their salad years really getting to know everyone. So they still have some deep friends in the cocktail circuit that not just give them good smut, but really good analysis as well. And they tend to argue for a smaller government with more ferocity than kind of anyone else will. So it's a little redoubt. Okay. And then it flips the other way. It goes a little bit lefty at times, but I don't want to say that's the main thing about it. But it'll publish these sort of maverick fiscal conservatives in a way that is difficult to get away with in this particular sort of FDR golden era. Things shift quite a lot after the war, but what doesn't change is the sense that is this very simple version, which is where the analogy is tightest, that you've got highbrow Washington and lowbrow Washington. And that's the difference in the New York Times and the New York Post. The New York Times is read around the world. It's got, you know, Princeton's Nobel Prize winning economist Paul Krugman as their main economics writer. It's got David Brooks, the sort of best-selling kind of soft liberal, wonderful thinker, as their main kind of social affairs, social analysis columnist. Thomas Friedman, who sort of renounced the Republican Party. It's really until John McWhorter kind of given up on the right, given up on the center. It's very left. It's very international. It's very highbrow. And no one on a New York subway that I saw even 10 years ago was caught reading the New York Times. People who actually take the subway read the Post.
Right. And just to give you a sense of what the Post is like by comparison, the top story is currently highest bidder, and it's a picture of Elon Musk when he smoked the marijuana on the Joe Rogan Experience, yes, with a little picture of the Twitter icon next to him. And it says, Elon Musk can't resist weed joke as he plots Twitter takeover. And then on the side panel of trending stories, the top one is woman duct taped aboard American Airlines flight faces record $82,000 fine from the Federal Aviation Authority.
Dude, the New York Post. Dude, it knows what the people need, you know.
Right.
Highest with the marijuana.
One of the other ones is, quote, now I'm pissed. Secret Service agents outraged by White House spin over first dog bites.
Dude, and this is such, I mean, that is, oh my God, what perfect timing. Because that is, the, you know, that's the great line in American journalism. Who came up with it? Someone around in the 30s, I think. Man bites dog, right? This is when you really carry a story in the highbrow news. But the New York Post is like, no, dog bites man. That's good enough for us. Here we go. And this is often New York subway has just had this terrible attack. And, you know, when I checked the New York Times front page, it's all the Ukraine war and sort of weepy, teary. And it is very sad. I mean, I immediately had my heart skip a beat when I thought about my friends in New York. I don't want to make light of it. But I can, you know, it's somehow not so surprising to me that the New York Post already a day later is kind of, is also making room for high jokes. And, you know, it's not pressing pause and like, now we have to just do shirt ripping, like tears for our city. It's got a very hardened New York attitude of like, we keep rolling, we keep going, we keep going. Okay. So the New York Post did the Hunter Biden laptop story before the 2020 election. And the Times said, this is fake news, this is Russian disinformation, and did not relent from that position for another year. And after the Times, followed the Washington Post, followed, you know, really the American mainstream. And I think that if those newspapers had reported that differently, the election might have been different. And as it turns out, with this kind of factual, like, I don't want... So you say, and you might very well be right, that the social media was already not monopolized in the sense that those distribution networks of information that were prone to be favorable to a story humiliating Joe Biden at a crucial political juncture were able to spread that story nevertheless, both by sharing the New York Post story and by sharing the rejections and denunciations of that story without basis coming from other mainstream outlets to say, look, it's rigged. These guys hate us. They reject us. And that also generates interest and information. That might all be true. For everyone that's not on Twitter, they were let down by the newspapers who, instead of telling their readers, here's the allegation, here's why we think it might not be true, but we can't be certain either way, and you should make your own judgment, instead said, no, here's the allegation. It must be fake news coming from the Russians who are trying to destroy our democracy.
So there's a really interesting point, I think, here, which is that social media is actually, in a lot of ways, still downstream of the traditional newspapers. The traditional newspapers may not always be read as much as they used to. They may not make as much money as they used to, but they still, by a large degree, kind of set the tone for sort of what are the big issues that are talked about. Or sometimes if they're not talking about something that people think they should be talking about, people talk about the fact that they're not talking about that thing, if that makes that makes any sense.
Right. But it's so, those people are the ones that I'm trying to avoid talking about, because the ones that I think really, like in any given election, for example, there's only 5%, 10% of the population that might change their mind. And I think that newspapers do have the best power to influence them. So the hardcore Trumpkins are going to be talking about the fact that the newspapers are not talking about it, for example. It's the person who is an engineer or an accountant or a street sweeper or a nurse, hairdresser, who really tries to avoid the news because they kind of don't trust anything. They say they don't trust anything. And they don't trust anything.
It turns out the voters who are most likely to switch their vote between elections are often those who engage the least with the news. They're usually called low information voters. And there's a chunk of them in a lot of US states who are absolutely crucial towards winning a national election. And
those are the guys that can be swayed, because low information is not the same as no information. But it is sometimes almost exactly the same, in the sense that they're the ones who would have been impressed by the story, if only because they would have seen it when getting into the subway, on the headlines at the candy store stand that's, you know, selling newspapers and candy and cigarettes. They would have seen that headline, oh my God, there's this thing. Or they don't see the headline, and failing to see it doesn't, you know, makes the difference between them making the decision one way or another, or them seeing it in like what they consider to be a bit of a tabloid, but then not seeing it picked up by the other more serious papers like the Wall Street Journal, which is a great newspaper. And so is the New York Times. You know, seeing it not be picked up there, they're like, well, I guess it can't really be true then. Probably the Post is just making it up at the last moment. I imagine that a lot of those in-between voters would have said at the time, we think the Post is just making it up. And by the way, you know, it turns out that maybe making your decision on the basis of whether Hunter Biden had rubbish emails showing him to be corrupt and promising Ukrainian gangsters contact with his father in exchange for money, maybe that shouldn't change the way that you vote.
And yeah, so I think there was also stuff about him personally using drugs and stuff in there as well, which was pretty hectic.
That almost certainly shouldn't change the way you vote. But it's just the most recent example of an October surprise. Every election has one, and the media's role in influencing that. And I think what Musk is trying to do is put himself in the position that next time there's an October surprise, he's kind of in the driver's seat of saying whether this thing gets censored out or not. And that does mean he's kind of bidding to be the next kingmaker in the world's most powerful country, which is why I think the story, for people who agree, for people who disagree with what he's doing, I think people should be thinking about it and talking about it, because it's weird. It's just come out. I don't know everything I think about it. Two scenarios. One seems good to me, one seems bad, although Nicholas kind of knocked down the bad one. So maybe if the bad one is good and the good one is good, he should just do it.
Can I just say that, you know, so I don't really like Elon that much, and I can't really tell you why. I have nothing, you know, I'm not one of these people who just hates people for being rich. I don't think that he's like some kind of mad threat to free speech. I like the fact that he's sending rockets to Mars, and I really am keen on his Martian colonization stuff. I think that stuff is awesome. And I think that he is doing the best thing that a billionaire can do, basically, by spending money on that stuff. That's exactly why we have billionaires.
That's what billionaires are for.
Right, right. But I don't know. I just kind of don't like his vibe. I know that's not a very intellectual take. So, you know, based off of entirely on that analysis, I'm not sure if he will do great things that I would consider wise with Twitter. But I will tell you something. There's going to be a lot of people who I don't think very highly of who are going to be very upset if he does take over Twitter. And for at least a month, it's going to be very funny watching people write hysterical opinion pieces about how Elon taking over Twitter is literally the worst thing that's ever happened in all of human history. And I guarantee you, if he does take over Twitter, there will be people 3 years from now who will be blaming literally everything that's gone wrong in America on Elon Musk taking over Twitter.
Yeah, and we are nowhere near the end. If the goal is for Twitter to be something that people don't even realize they're using, like I don't even realize that I'm using Vodacom on my cell phone. The only time I know it is like when my phone got stolen and I had to go get a new SIM card. I was like, oh, I guess I'm on Vodacom because I can't go to the MTN store, right? For Twitter to get to that stage, which I think that's what we need to aim for. It's not going to happen in 3 years. It's not going to happen in 5 years. It's going to take a generation or two. But, you know, if we ever have grandchildren, I would love, I think that the world would be in a pretty good place. If all I knew was that in like 50 years, it's like Verizon versus T-Mobile. Like there are adverts on TV, but really no one cares. It's like less important than whether you buy a Mac or a PC, like a, like who cares? You bought a Dell or an HP. Are they even different companies? You got a, I don't even know what the other computer, what is my computer? My computer says HP. So I guess it's an HP. Like who cares? Right. That's not going to happen tomorrow. I think that it'll happen quicker if Elon Musk, I don't want to call him Elon. If Elon Musk pulls this off.
Yeah. Look, the more Twitters there are, I think the better. I definitely agree with you on that point, because I think that the free market in a lot of ways is the best way to solve the free market, and some nudging of the SD market are the best ways to solve a lot of the problems that we have at the moment, rather than, you know, the heavy hand of the state. And if Elon can pull off a big change to, you know, how the social media environment works, if he can kind of break up that feeling that social media is dominated by a whole bunch of people who all act and think the same, right? Because that's definitely the perception on the right now, is that the social media is all run by kind of left-wing sort of West Coast woke people. And if Elon Musk owns one of the social media companies, he is 100% going to change that. And I think that would be very good. It would break up this feeling that, you know, all social media is against us, that a lot of people on the right have. And I think that would also lead them into having a less sort of conspiratorial crouch.
Yes. Yes. Please.
So like good luck to Elon.
Can I just dwell for a moment on conspiratorial crouch? Is that, I mean, so it's like the mood that, like if a human monkey is like on a camping trip, or, you know, and you're in the woods and you drop your pants and you're making a poo and you're crouching, like that is the most paranoid that a human, like you are so paranoid. So that's the conspiratorial crouch that like so many conservatives are unfortunately always stuck in. They're like their neurons are firing in the same pattern as a person pooping in the woods. Let it be over. Let us end that and free these people from their worries that everyone's out to get them.
Definitely. So good luck to Jan. Now, we could move on to the next topic, but we've already gone an hour and 15 minutes, so I really do think we should call it there. Do you have anything to say in... I'll time it in 5 minutes.
Okay. I think it's been like... I suppose my reflections on the war in Ukraine are difficult to compress into that period. Let me try. The key humanitarian incidents in Bucha, Mariupol, what is it, Dagestan? There's a couple of places where...
There's another one, I think, in the east somewhere, or in the north somewhere. I can't remember what it's called. It's got a name with a B, I think.
Yeah.
That's not Bucha.
Bucha is one, but I think that my own view is that I haven't seen enough evidence to make up my mind one way or another. I think that's controversial. In the English media, as far as I can tell, everyone's made up their mind that what happened is that Russians killed Ukrainians in extrajudicial ways and very terrible ways, so on and so forth. The chemical attacks in Mariupol is very different. Even a lot of you very pro-Ukrainian people.
Yeah, the Ukrainian government itself has said, we don't know about that, hey?
Yeah. So I really am, you know, I've been on South African radio and TV enough times when like everyone in our Twitter sphere and professional media had made up their minds that some incident was racist. And I said, let's get some more evidence first. And those were not nearly as serious in the sense that, well, you know, some of them have been murder trials, but some of them have not been. None of them have been mass murder. So this is more serious. And I understand that as it gets more and more serious, it's harder and harder for people to insist on patience. I do think it's a good idea to insist on patience. I also think that there's going to be an important distinction to make, which is that in a proper country, the law should be more reliable. In other words, if the law finds someone guilty, it's more likely to be the case that they're guilty. Innocent, likewise. In a situation of war, it might be the case that there's insufficient evidence to find war violations of basic human rights, but that nevertheless a lot of reasonable people say there have been such violations because in the conditions of war, it's harder to gather evidence. At the same time, it seems like investigators have arrived kind of earlier than ever, who might be able to get corroboration for some of the claims that are being made. I was initially, for example, totally persuaded that the satellite footage of the bodies laid out in Bucha were corroborating evidence, because that satellite evidence purported to show that those bodies had been laying out there for like at least a week or whatever it was during Russian occupation. But subsequent evidence that I've seen about like who owns the satellite company, what it would take to fake the dates for the footage to be real, but just the little date, which is like just a little kind of superimposed picture, to be jiggered. That made me think, you know what? I'm actually not convinced. It doesn't cross the reasonable doubt threshold. I still have some reasonable doubts. That's one thing. The second thing is that in terms of who's winning and who's losing, I think our conversation last time about the war, you said 70-30 in favor of Ukraine. I said 50-50. My theory was that Russia was spread out like five fingers across the country and that it could gather up into a fist, it would be winning, but that if any one of those fingers was snapped, it wouldn't be able to gather up into a fist and so it would lose. I feel vindicated in that judgment. I think the withdrawal of the Russian troops from the north, from on the clock from like 11 o'clock till 2 o'clock, put it in a good position to redeploy those troops and go for a much more conventional style warfare. In fact, this sort of Napoleonic trick, which I said that they were on the wrong side of, they now seem to be on the right side of. It seems to me like Ukraine is unable to redeploy vast numbers of its troops. I think they've been able to maybe move 15,000. But Russia's been able to move 60,000. And so this is exactly the trick of Napoleon that I was saying Russia was on the wrong side of. Now it's on the right side of. And that trick is to, if Russia's got less troops and relatively similar kind of tech in a lot of ways, what you really want to do is split your opponent and have your forces concentrated against a part of your opponent, a section of your opponent's forces. So if you've got 10 and they've got 10, you want to divide them into 5 and 5 and then have 8 of yours go against 5 of theirs and then 2 of yours tie the other 5 down. So 8 against 5, you've got a huge numerical advantage in that domain. That does seem to be the trick that the Russians have pulled off. I think that their official version is that they withdrew as a gesture of goodwill. I don't think that is their official version. That strikes me as crazy. Yeah. Ukrainian official version is that they were driven back. That's also crazy, as far as I can tell. So I think that it was 50-50 and that if they had stuck with their, you know, five finger strategy, it would have been very easy for them to lose, very easy for them to win, but very easy for them to lose. At the moment, I think it's shifted from the day that they withdrew. I thought it's 80-20 in their favor. In fact, when I say 80-20, I'm trying to sort of build in a lot of epistemic humility because, my knowledge of military strategy is limited to reading a handful of books. And they have kind of been tangentially about military strategy. There may have been history books about wars. I've never taken a class explicitly about it. So maybe that's appropriate, but it's also like inappropriate in a way, because as a layman, I feel kind of in this strange place where I think the Russians are bound to win. And it's been giving me strange dreams, like nightmares. And I think that I'll finish on the, so first thing, what, okay. So second thing is sort of, how's the military strategy going? First thing is, how's the humanitarian crisis going? And I do sound like a Russian apologist. I know that, you know, I'm saying on the humanitarian crisis, I'm not condemning anyone because I don't know. Well, I just don't. And that is where I'm sitting. And I know that's not going to be popular. And on the second thing, where's the military strategy going? I think Russia's winning. I'm sure some people will think that's not right. Definitely have had meetings with people who, you know, if you say you think the Russians are winning, they interpret that normatively rather than as a mere description about how things are going. On the third category, I'll just say about sort of Western response, two things. One is that I think America really is setting up a very terrible thing to do with a bond war in 10 years' time. And let's talk about that another day.
Yeah, that needs a full episode.
Yeah, I had a nice listen to a podcast from Larry Summers. But the short thing to say is, you know, both Donald Trump and Joe Biden have described the Russians as performing genocide in Ukraine. And I think that the Western rhetoric has hit rock bottom. I think it's outrageous. I think it's disgraceful. It's completely following the script set up by Putin, who said that there was a genocide happening in Ukraine against Russians. Now they're saying, now Biden and Trump agree that there's a genocide happening against Ukrainians. We had an episode earlier this year about genocide and the dilution of terms of condemnation, of esteem units, of esteem supplies, of shame that are hugely important to keeping our society together. Murder is murder. Genocide is genocide. Rape is rape. These words as allegations or conclusions or condemnations have very real weight, which is being profoundly corrupted. And, you know, we've debated, like, I think it's a terrible mistake to say what's happened in China is a genocide against the Uyghurs.
Yes, I've, but we have argued about that. I have disagreed on that one.
Yeah. And so I have said that it's a terrible mistake to say that what is happening, you know, people who've said that there's a genocide against farmers in South Africa are making a terrible mistake. On the flip side, I really appreciate that you recommended my piece on Rwanda. There was a genocide in Rwanda, and none of the American leadership were willing to call that out, nor was the UN.
One of the worst things the UN has ever involved in. Okay, so yeah. that's 10 minutes. so
that was, I just not 10 minutes. That was 7
minutes. 10 minutes.
That no, was, it was 1:54.
Okay. So I am convinced that there has been some humanitarian stuff. I think that Russia has helped the Syrian government do nasty things in Syria. I think that the Russians have done stuff in Chechnya that is not too far beyond
some of the stuff. Completely agree. I agree about that.
Right. So I think that, you know, some of this evidence, obviously I agree that the satellite stuff, I think if it's found that it's definitely, you know, the data is correct, then that's really difficult to argue with. I think it's more likely that the data is correct. And there's other stuff too. Like, for example, you know, there was from a different source, I saw that one of the trenches, which where a lot of the bodies are, was dug at least a couple of days earlier. There's also other stuff, like there were foreign journalists there quite quickly. And there was also, I remember journalists talking about the smell of rotting flesh in a very real way. And that is kind of difficult to fix. I mean, you know, there's a million explanations for it. But anyway, so I'm convinced that some real, real nasty stuff has gone on there. I do also agree that the genocide word is not one to be thrown around lightly, and I would not have used it. I also think that Biden just kind of said it because he just says things, and he didn't really think about it, and then he realized that it would be humiliating to try and go back on it because he'd already walked back like five freaking statements over the last month, and so that's why he doubled down on it.
He did walk it back, though.
Sort of, kind of. It wasn't.
He did. He said, "I didn't say that as the president. I said that in my personal capacity." That is walking the plank. Cyril Ramaphosa, eat your heart.
Yeah, that is the most. That is the most pathetic walk back I've ever heard. Anyway, as for the military thing, I think you are underestimating the scale of damage that has been inflicted on some of the Russian. What are they called? There's all the cool kids talk about it, BTGs. Battle tactical groups or something, which is like the way that the Russian army is organized. Not a term I knew before this war, so just take that into account as I talk about them. But something like half of them seem to have been deployed towards Kiev in the north of the country. And just based on the sheer amount of stuff that was left behind, stuff that was blown up, stuff that was abandoned, stuff that was just trashed, personal effects left by soldiers, wrecked camps, abandoned equipment. I think they got pretty badly mauled, and the Russians realized that any kind of maximalist goal where they would, you know, be able to really just pin the Ukrainians against the wall and do whatever they wanted is completely off the table now, and that they've realizing that they've gone, okay, we're going to cut our losses on that one. We're going to redeploy to the east and see, you know, if we can achieve something like some of the goals that you talked about as being more realistic for Russia, like, you know, taking the separatist areas.
Well, more desirable. I always said it would be terrible. I always said the worst mistake they can make is to try and take Kiev. And the second worst mistake they can make is to try and take Odessa.
Right. I think both of those are now off the table as far as their goals and things, unless, you know, suddenly they destroyed the whole Ukrainian army in a big encirclement or something. By that being said, I think the morale and quality stuff has continued to be in Ukraine's favor. I think that they're now receiving, they're going to be start receiving some heavy equipment from Western countries. I know that they look like they're getting heavy artillery and tanks from the other sort of Slavic countries, which
the Russians have said they will bomb as soon as they cross the border.
Right. I think some of them may have already gone across. I saw footage of one of the Slovak heavy artillery pieces look like it was in Ukraine, but not on the front line, but like mucking about in the woods in Western
Ukraine. The reason I bring this up is because, like, from the, you know, I think the first time we had a conversation about the war, about the military side of the war after it started, I said my biggest question is how successful are the Russians being at destroying. It was the first time they bombed, missile attacked near Lviv.
Yeah, there's that training center. Yeah, right by the border of Poland.
And they said they've managed to take out, like, you know, soldiers where foreigners are, and they've managed to take on an ammunition depot. So when the West was supplying the Ukrainians with N-Laws, javelins, stingers, and so on, these are handheld units which can easily be put inside of ordinary vehicles. And I've seen footage of, you know, you have a few of these units inside the back of a car, and traffic has not been stopped because the Russians and the Ukrainians don't want to be seen to be stopping ordinary civilians from escaping or supplies from coming back in, and so on and so forth. So smuggling that stuff has been really easy. Do you think it's easy for tanks in substantial numbers or artillery units? You know, if you think about those columns that have been famously displayed for weeks on end of Russian units, both originally by Kiev and now, you know, sort of coming in from Russia into the east of Ukraine. If you really want to get substantial numbers of heavy units in, it's hard to do it without putting in a column like that. And if columns, you know, so maybe you can get one or two, you know, specialized multiple rocket or missile launcher things through. Even that would be tricky. But if you have a whole column, it strikes me that there's no chance of getting that through Russia's domination of the air. And that if you're not doing a whole column, you're just doing one or two units, and that's not really making a difference.
So two things on that. One, I think that Ukraine's air defense systems in the west of the country remain fairly robust. And secondly, it's not just roads, it's also rail. And we know that the rail system is working because all the Ukrainians have made a point of taking all the foreign presidents who've come to visit Kiev
by train
on the rail system.
Yeah.
They took Boris in on the train.
But so how difficult? I mean, that's the easiest thing to disrupt if Russia wants to disrupt.
Right. So this is evidence. This is part of the evidence I use to suggest that their missiles, that the Ukraine's air defense system, the west of the country, is still relatively robust, is that they haven't been able to destroy the rail networks properly that lead into Ukraine.
Why would they have wanted to destroy the rail system?
Well, so that you can't drive tanks in on a train.
No, but there's been no tanks coming in.
There have been already some.
You're saying like two from Czech Republic in the last week. The major...
I think it was 100. I may be wrong, but I think it was 100. T-72s. Okay.
Well, I think this is interesting because it does highlight a point of contention. And I'm not sure that I'm right, and I'm not sure that you're right. But I think we've identified a good point of contention, which I have not seen discussed on Russian, English. Like, no one wants to talk about how effective has Russia been at closing the bottleneck of new supplies of heavy equipment, and how successful is Ukraine at keeping them open. Okay, if it turns out to be the case that Russia, there's like 400 kilometers of train track that Russia just can't find any point to blow up, or blow up sufficiently badly that it can't be restored in time for sort of mass hundreds of tanks to be taken over, then I think my appraisal of 80-20 is probably off. That is probably, you know, overestimating Russian power. Yeah, for sure.
So I think, just to finish this off, that there's a really the next super decisive phase is about to come up. It is the battle for the east. The Russians are going to make a big attack and attempt to encircle the big Ukrainian forces on that side there. They've redeployed all their stuff to that side, so they're going to make a proper go of it. They're not going to be spread out like they were in the earlier parts of the campaign, which definitely weakened
them. What's coming now is going to be worse than anything we've seen in terms of...
It's going to be a huge battle. And the Ukrainians have already been saying this. They say it's going to be like World War II, and I think they're probably actually right.
World War I, this is the Somme. Here comes the Somme, and whoever wins the Somme... Yeah.
Right. And that's going to be decisive. If Ukraine can push them back or hold them back, then I think that the momentum will swing in such a way as Ukraine might even be able to make significant counterattacks. Whereas if the Ukrainian army is sufficiently mauled, and maybe some of them are trapped and destroyed, then it's going to be very difficult for them to control the east of the country, and Russia will pretty much have free range over it, because a lot of that part of the country is flat steppe. So it's, you know, this is actually where a lot of the tank battles of the Second World War kind of took place. It's really good for sort of big tank maneuver warfare stuff. And the Russians in the east do have the advantage of still having, you know, vastly high numbers of aircraft and stuff, which is most effective when the ground is flat. And the one thing the Ukrainians haven't gotten nearly enough of for their purposes, and this is why they keep talking about it, is anti-air systems and aircraft. And this is why they keep banging on about it, because they know that in the steppe, and they've said it also quite bluntly, they cannot relieve the siege of Mariupol until they have better cover from the air. And as long as Russia maintains that, it's going to have a lot of advantages in the east, even if it's sort of general quality and morale, I think, is not that great. You know, when you're being bombed from the sky, it doesn't matter how motivated you are. You really can't do that much, as a lot of armies have shown over time, particularly when it's flat fields. There isn't really anywhere to hide your vehicles. So I think we are about to see a very decisive, very cataclysmic battle. And I guess that after that's happened, we will reassess where we're at.
So I'm saying 80-20 now for the Russians. Maybe I'm taking it too far. What you've just said is making me feel like I have. But let me bring it back to 70-30. So I was at 50-50 before. You were at 70-30 in favor of the Ukrainians before. I'm now at 70-30 in favor of the Russians. Are you still at 70-30 in favor of the Ukrainians?
Yeah, I'm still in the same place. Like I said, if there's a big push that traps their army in the east, I think Ukraine's in very big trouble. But I'm not sure if the Russians really are going to be able to do that. They've had a rough war. I mean, Ukraine's also had a rough war, but for them, in their mind, if they don't win, you know, it's the end of the freaking universe for them. At least that seems to be what the Ukrainian side believes. And as a result, I think in the end, they're going to probably stick it out.
It is interesting to me. In a way, this still comes down to like this question about morale, where my view is this sort of psychological hypothesis that humans in general can be much better at getting along with the job if they're unhappy than people in capitalist liberal democracies tend to believe. Because as Orwell says in my recommendation of a week or whatever it was ago, capitalism promises happiness today. Socialism promises happiness tomorrow. But fascism promises unhappiness. And that can be really popular. And Orwell was saying that sort of with his tongue in his cheek, especially because it was a sort of deference to Hitler's greatest line, which in a discussion with, I must admit, a Russian friend, I realized really was sort of the Ukrainian line. Right. And is the line that Nicholas has been pushing. Hitler's greatest line was, it's better to end in suffering than to suffer without end. Right. When you're fighting an existential war, if you give up, you'll be humiliated for the rest of your life. You'll suffer without end. You know, you'll have your family around you, but everyone will know that you're a bit of a loser who gave in to the Russian machine. And it's better to just die, to end suffering as a hero, than to resign and suffer endlessly the humiliation of resignation, and I do think that in that sense, Orwell was his project explicitly was to think about ordinary Nazis like human beings. And not like evil monsters. To think of the people that were flying over his head as good fathers and good husbands, many of them good brothers and sons to their mothers, good honest citizens in so many ways. You know, to say like if I could kill them, if I could kill Hitler, I would, but that doesn't mean that they're all evil and so on and so forth. He really was quite seriously trying to humanize the Nazis. And so I'm flagging that because in bringing in this thought, I'm not trying to dehumanize anyone. I'm trying to say that I think that the ultimate humanization of Nazism that he could find was that if you let go of the ideology, ultimately you've got a lot of people fighting for survival. And Michael Sarre does the same thing in his book about the Civil War in America, where he humanizes the Confederate side. So I think, you know, if you think of the Russians as being like the Nazis or the Confederates, or you think of the Ukrainians as being like the Nazis or the Confederates, there is this question that Nicholas and I keep clashing up on, which is, you know, if you just think a bit about them like human beings, morale becomes the question. And the person that's just fighting for their survival, is in a deeply human way going to have a morale upper hand. So that can be rendered nugatory by sufficient air supremacy or firepower right. Overwhelming.
But also, but it is if they really start,
important. I agree.
About if they that. Start losing in the East and they have a big setback, I don't think Ukraine has had a massive setback since the early days of the war. And so in a sense, their morale could be a little bit brittle in that they think we're destined. I mean, what, you know, as good as opinion polls are in a war, the opinion polls so far show that like 85% of Ukrainians at least will tell a pollster that they think they're going to win the war. And that's if there's some sort of huge setback, there's going to be people looking at each other going, no, well, you see, it's actually this person's fault, or it's this person's fault. We were betrayed by this one. And then the moment you kind of turn inwards like that and you start blame casting around, you can very quickly run into, what are we even fighting for? Because our own side is rubbish, blah, 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 blah. So that's, I think, the danger of them losing a very big battle is that they might sort of go, oh, no, you know, what went wrong? We were winning and now we're all disaster. I think this has been the problem for the Russians. They were pretty competent that they were just going to walk over this country. And it turns out to be much harder. And I think that's one of the reasons morale is not that high.
That's where we disagree, but I'm much less interested in that because that's where I just think you're talking the same nonsense as everyone else. You don't know what the Russians are thinking. You have no idea. You can't speak Russian. You don't know Vladimir Putin's middle name. You don't know what he had for breakfast. You have no idea what he was thinking.
Yeah, but neither do you, dude. And I think the evidence suggests...
Exactly. That, but I'm not the one pretending. You just claimed that you knew what they were thinking. I'm not claiming that.
No, but I'm claiming to guess. And I think that my guess is not based on nothing. It's based on what they did. But anyway, we're at 1 minute, 1 hour 40. So let's close it there because I think that we both said what we want to say.
Wait, hold on. I want to come back to my point, which is that I think our disagreement, look, this disagreement about what were the Russians thinking, I think really is very silly. Because neither of us should pretend to know what the Russians were thinking when they invaded. Hopefully history will reveal when sort of letters and proper documents are exposed. And that unfortunately might only happen in 20 years. I certainly try to avoid pretending to know. I think our interesting disagreement comes back to the same point. I think the fact that the Russians have sometimes been caught on Ukrainian videotape or sorry, not videotape, audio saying, "Hi, Mom, this is really terrible. I wish I wasn't here." I don't take that stuff particularly seriously because I don't trust it. But there is a lot of evidence for real gloominess, as you were saying, sort of Russian positions that were kind of messy and just sort of I think that I really don't see much joy. I see very little joy. There's an absence of evidence, which is evidence of something about morale. But to my mind, my psychological reading is that until the World Cup, the Soccer World Cup, I really had never seen a Russian smile in public at a stranger, excepting for one time that I was in the subway where there was a clown at sort of 1 o'clock in the morning who was doing tricks for vodka shots. And when the World Cup came, there were literally government social workers going around teaching train conductors and the like how to smile to strangers. I do think that there are deep cultural differences across places. And I do think that if I'm right, it's because I have the benefit on the morale question of knowing that Russian people continue to be as effective or ineffective as they otherwise were in a very grumpy mood. And if you're right, it's because I have overestimated my insider knowledge. In other words, I have thought that, you know, these people really are quite different and they sort of enjoy suffering. Not enjoy suffering, but they can endure suffering and continue to be quite effective.
Right, they have more a higher tolerance for it.
They have a higher tolerance for it than, for example, I think Americans or English people would. Because you know, I've just overestimated that. I've kind of fallen for a stereotype. A couple of jokes I've become the kid eating the mud cake, I don't know what to hope for. Well, I don't know if I hope I'm right or I'm wrong.
Remember, dude, that the people dying on the Western side are, as Putin and Macron have called them, the brotherly nation of the Russians. You know, you may be right that Russians have a high tolerance for suffering, but it may also be the case that Ukrainians do too.
Oh, so, well, I think on that front we kind of agree, which is why I was bringing up the Orwell quote there. It's better to end in suffering than to suffer without end. Everyone seems to agree that Ukrainians have a very high tolerance for suffering, but they seem to say so, and I think this is a very reasonable thing to say, for reasons that have nothing to do with Ukrainianness and everything to do with existential threat, right? So if any people is being threatened with total annihilation, and I completely disagree that that's what they're being threatened with, but if people genuinely perceive that that's what they're being threatened with, then their tolerance for suffering is going to be almost immeasurable. That hardly needs any cultural explanation at all. It's just circumstantial. The reason I'm reaching out for the cultural explanation, and I think this is, we're kind of on common ground here, is we think that Russia's in a very different position because it's an optional war for Russia, whereas it's an existential war for Ukraine. Now, actually, I think it's an optional war for both, but it's certainly perceived that way by most people on both sides. And where there's an optional war, America has displayed, for example, in its withdrawal from Afghanistan, how profoundly namby-pamby and suffering averse and sort of counterproductively suffering averse a leadership can be of a people, and with some reason, in the sense that like the people can be a little bit like the princess and the pea, hypersensitive to issues in the counterproductive sense that by trying to avoid pain, they end up inflicting more pain on themselves than they would if they just had some tolerance for suffering. I think that it's in that regard that I look for, because it's an optional war for Russia, I think that I look for this explanation. And it might very well be wrong in two ways. It might be the case that most Russians don't think of this as an optional war. I don't know the polling. It might be that, well, by this stage, most Russians believe that if they hadn't invaded first, Ukraine would have invaded.
I do think that that has been the focus of Russian messaging to its own people, is to say, you know, it's we win this or it's the end of Russia. I think that that has definitely been a message that's been going out to Russian people.
I haven't seen that very much. To turn it. I watch a lot of Russian news. I can't say that I've seen that much, but I can believe you that it is something that's been put out there, because it would be, to my mind, the most logical way to try and shore up morale. If it turned out that the gloominess, the gloomy face, is reflective of an incapacitated will. I don't know. I end in a question mark.
And the ending of all is a question mark. You know, I just want to pat us both on the back here for managing to get to 2 hours again.
No, we haven't.
Almost. Okay. Let me try close. I just want to add one thing, and you're not allowed to say anything about it. The world has changed because of this war. Japan is taking in some refugees. And if you know anything about Japan, this is like hell freezing over kind of stuff. Anyway. Okay. Recommendations, do you have any?
I would say, no, you go first.
So I guess I can recommend the editorial by the National Review on the Shanghai lockdown. Just saying, look, you know, China kind of in a lot of ways started some of the stupid stuff that's come down the pike in policy terms of COVID, with its very militant lockdowns. And it got a lot of praise from a sort of technocratic minded kind of person as this is the way to do things. And I think that they have shown in Shanghai that they really, you know, don't actually have a great strategy for dealing with COVID. I think this is different to the way that Japan and South Korea have done it. I think they have managed to you know, prevent COVID from getting to themselves quite early, and still, you know, they've been tough, but not like not welding people into apartments tough.
They were not tough in Japan and South Korea. They were suggestive.
Okay, they were suggestive, but you know, they did travel bans, for example, which
that's not tough,
right? But the West was too tough for the West to do.
It's too smart. So. Right. I'm getting in the way of your recommendation. I'm
anyway, so they just say, can we stop saying that China's got such a great record of dealing with COVID, and also like the Chinese government is, shall we say, not the best. So I'll put that in the link in the show notes. But National Review, the editors, the title is The Shanghai Lockdown.
Okay, I'd like to check that out, because I got to say, I feel like the lesson of the Shanghai Lockdown might be that I hate totalitarianism, but sometimes it works. I don't approve of it. I mean, I think it'd be worth it to go
there. But has it actually worked in Shanghai? And I would be very skeptical that it has.
I'll be happy to check it out. My suggestion is, let me make it this one. The Hoover Institute's Goodfellows podcast or YouTube thing. If you listen to us, you should definitely listen to them, because I think similar in values in a lot of ways, different obviously in some ways, but super, super accomplished know-it-alls. Whereas we're like chill dudes who are trying to figure it out as we go. Each has its advantages. Their advantage is that they do interviews with other people all of the time, which I think really brings out the best in them. And sometimes it's really boring, but the one that they have with Larry Summers this week is amazing. He is a slimy centrist. Okay? By which I mean that he's like so smart and so condensed, but so, I think, so burnt by when he was removed as president of Harvard for making comments about genetic differences between men and women 15 years ago, that he has learned this second layer of language in which you're able to say exactly the next door neighbor to the thing that you mean, and you sort of leave the cookie crumbs, and it's very Hansel and Gretel, and by the end of it,
You figure out what they're actually saying. It's like a puzzle. Like, you need to build the puzzle.
But it's like very direct. He's like punching you with breadcrumbs to follow up the garden path to the cookie monster. I don't know. If that makes any sense to you, then what he says will probably also make some sense to you. And if it doesn't, then never mind.
Awesome stuff. All right. Anyway, with 7 minutes to spare, we thank you very much for listening.
You see how disappointed we are. We've cut ourselves.
Oh, God. And all I can ask is that you keep the flag of liberty flying.